Good day, all, and welcome to our launch of DS&I Deconstructs. We want to thank you for joining us as we bring together our distinguished guests to discuss topics related to the efficacy of land trusts and community organizing, and the application of racial equity at its center. Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, DS&I, formed in 1984, and is a community-based planning and organizing group in the Dudley area of Roxbury, Boston, that manages the largest urban community land trust in the country. This includes homes, community gardens and parks, and playgrounds. DS&I is a member organization with a 35-member board made up of community residents, area businesses, nonprofits, and religious institutions who help to guide the work of DS&I, which focuses primarily on community economic development, leadership development, and collaboration, and the development of the land trust. In this podcast series, we will engage our guests and listeners to question, analyze, and think towards the futurity of our community and city together. Hello, and welcome to our fifth episode of DS&I Deconstructs. John, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Isn't this so wonderful? We are actually at number five.
Episode five.
This is great. And not only is it great to be this far in our own process and launching, but I am so happy to introduce Dr. Thea James and Dr. James Jennings. Dr. Thea James is Vice President of Mission, Associate Chief Medical Officer and Executive Director of the Health Equity Accelerator at Boston Medical Center. She is an Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine and Director of the Violence Intervention Advocacy Program at BMC. Dr. James is a founding member of the Health Alliance for Violence Intervention, the HAVI. In 2011, she was appointed to Attorney General Eric Holder's National Task Force on Children Exposed to Violence. As Vice President of Mission, Dr. James works with caregivers throughout BMC. Additionally, she has primary responsibility for coordinating and maximizing BMC's relationships and strategic alliances with a wide range of local, state, and national organizations, including community agencies, housing advocates, foundations, and multi-sector industries that partner with BMC to meet the full spectrum of patients' needs. And we are so happy at Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative to also be a partner with Dr. Thea James. Today, we are also welcomed by Dr. James Jennings, who is Professor Emeritus of Urban and Environmental Policy and Planning at Tufts University. He has taught graduate courses in social policy, community development, and urban issues in the area of education, housing, and economic development. Earlier, he served as director of the William Monroe Trotter Institute at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Dr. Jennings has provided research and technical assistance to many public organizations seeking local demographic and economic analysis pertaining to a range of neighborhood issues. These organizations include the Hyams Foundation, the NAACP Boston Branch, the Boston Foundation, Higher Ground, and other organizations, as well as the City of Boston. Welcome, both Dr. James and Dr. Jennings.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
So I'd like to just get right started with the conversation. Is that okay with the two of you? Here are big few picture questions. The racial wealth gap. How did we get here?
I think there are certainly a lot of historical factors explaining the racial wealth gap, beginning with slavery over hundreds of years, but not just slavery, as abominable as that was. It was also what followed slavery, massive segregation, racialized segregation, the denial of economic and social and health resources to the Black community, intergeneration wealth transfer was more possible for white households and white families than Blacks also explains the racial wealth gap. We all come from families where we had very, very hardworking people. Unfortunately, our hardworking did not generate the same benefits as for whites. And so a lot of reasons, but historical and also continuing policies and practices continue to explain this racial wealth gap.
I think to pick up on what Dr. Jennings said, particularly around policies, I think about how policies have had an impact in a time that's fairly proximal to now, like the 1930s, right after the Great Depression of 1929, and our country had this huge economic problem. And FDR, our president at the time, was trying to resuscitate America from this economic disaster. And one of the things he did was to create pathways for people to build wealth. And when you really think about it, you know, he chose one of the most common pathways to building wealth in America, which is home ownership because of the benefits of home equity. So, you know, from that perspective, it was a fairly brilliant plan, except that pathway was not open to people who were people of color, brown and black people. And by that, I mean, he actually, his administration created policies that actually drew lines called red lines all across the country through cities. And if you lived behind those red lines, where you lived was deemed lower status. The property was not valuable. It was devalued, which meant that you did not have access to the financial services. You know, you could not, your house could not be valued in a way in which you could build equity in it and that type thing. So you sort of like, he sort of like created in that moment these two distinct sort of socioeconomic populations that exist to this day. And the interesting thing about that, when you look at how, what impact that has over time, those redlining maps, and they represent cities all across America, they are the same maps. They match the COVID maps today. The same zip codes, you know, the same neighborhoods that were redlined are the same ones where COVID impacted people the most in terms of
around the country.
Around the country, in terms of illness and death. And so it's interesting just to see how that manifests over time, you know, when you have an intentionality to do something like that. And when I hear people talk about it was unintentional, I don't understand how it could be. If you create a system so that everyone has access to wealth, then there's no lines. There's no, we'll do this unless you're here or you're this person. And so I think that is one really pivotal moment in time that sort of set the stage for what we see even today.
Really appreciate you bringing that up. I've also heard this term you may be familiar with, syndemic. You know, when you talk about COVID also following these red lines, it's racism and the pandemic of COVID coexisting at the same time. And hence, some people are calling that a syndemic. So I really appreciate the fact that you framed that right along those same red lines, we're seeing impacts that have specifically to do with COVID today.
I would only add that there were also many, many responses, violent responses to Black people who wanted to move out of these redlining areas. And so every once in a while, you know, you would have the first Black family on this block or whatever. And there's just a history of white violence on the part of white homeowners who resisted any kind of Black mobility out of these redlined areas.
That's interesting. Dr. James brought up the pathways discussion. You know, you talked about FDR, and one of them is home ownership. And I'm thinking when I was in graduate school, a certain professor talked about how part of the, you know, the immigrants to this country, especially within the context of Boston and Massachusetts, had the highest home ownership, right? I was Black and Latino and, you know, so I'm just thinking about what, because we still talk about that as a wealth builder, right? I mean, in terms of the community land trust and all that, we still talk about building wealth based on home ownership. So just thinking a little bit about what you think the role and the impact has been in terms of Black home ownership on reducing this racial wealth gap.
Well, I think, as Dr. James mentioned, and I definitely agree, home ownership is a critical factor, a critical piece in building wealth and equity. It's also critical in starting businesses because people can borrow equity to start businesses, but it's not a panacea. A few thoughts about this. One, Black home ownership is something that's necessary, but it has to be accompanied by other responses, like access to living wage jobs, access to good health, a response to gentrification and displacement. So again, Black home ownership is very important, but it's it has to be part of a comprehensive package, I think.
I think it's sort of like what's a natural ecosystem for many white people. It just doesn't, you know, exist for Black and brown people. You know, the white population sort of, you know, they build wealth without fanfare. It happens, you know, automatically with your 403B or your 401K. There's an entire ecosystem of building wealth. But as you said, Dr. Jennings, you know, for many Black people, it doesn't, you know, exist in that way. It requires, as you said, it requires a living wage job. And a living wage job is like a steady sort of stream of income. But, you know, there are other things as well, you know, that can contribute to your income that you may not have access to. You know, you may not have one of these 403Bs or 401Ks. You may not have been able to get the education to get you a job that offers you those things. You may not be able to get interest from something, you know, that you own in some way. So you only, income is not enough. You also need to be able to accumulate and so that you have things that are everlasting, you know, that you can rely on when you face a challenge. So it's very, very different, you know, to just have a job versus having accumulated wealth. It's a very, very different thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think as we were talking and sort of listening to the different perspectives there, I wanted to think about what other sort of economic resources already exist within the Black community. So we've talked about home ownership and what that means. You know, and we know all this research that's out there around this is what the Black communities were, this is the white communities were, this is, you know, in terms of being stark about the racial wealth gap. So thinking about what other resources were out there.
And I think this is a very important question because it's not as if the Black community don't have anything. We have some issues and some challenges. I mean, poverty is devastating, of course. Unemployment is devastating. But we need to strategize about how to take resources that are perhaps potential resources even and actualize them. And one resource in Boston that we do have is youth. I think something like 80-85% of all five-year-olds in Boston are Black and Latinx children. That's our future. And so that becomes a very important economic resource, not only for our community, but for the entire city. When you look at land, although we're fighting gentrification and displacement, we still sit on a lot of land in our communities that has to be protected. We may not own that land, but we've been sitting on that land for many generations. We also have tremendous consumer spending power. I looked at the 2019 consumer survey of consumer expenditures, and I just used some GIS to look at what this might look like for Mattapan, a neighborhood where 85% of the residents are Black. In 2019, this is after COVID, the total spending was something like $500 million. So the question for me is, where's that money going? we're spending that money, but do we have the infrastructure to keep that money in the community for longer periods of time? We heard the report on the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston where blacks have a net worth of $8. If we step back, however, and use the community as the unit of analysis, we see that in Mattapan, that net worth is basically $6 or $7 billion when you add up the assets and the debts and that sort of thing. So again, we have resources. We just have to figure out how to strategize to take advantage and protect those resources. Because as you mentioned, Dr. James, black homeownership is fine, but if I lose my job tomorrow, who's gonna step in and displace me? Because that's been happening a lot as well.
Dr. Jennings, you lifted up something that is really important, this idea of land and how we are sitting on land. It's not just about houses, but it is about the land. So I wanted to ask the two of you, in terms of maybe an alternative or a way to look at how we use our land, do you think cooperative housing or community land trust could be a part of the solution?
I think that community land trusts are definitely a part of the solution. You know, and John, please correct me if I'm wrong in any way, but as, you know, nonprofits that are like stewards of the land in a place-based sort of arrangement, and stewards of like affordable housing, community gardens, and, you know, civic centers and various different things that might be there, you actually have the ability to prevent gentrification, for example. And even people who own homes, you know, in areas on land that you own, when people move, they get to generate some wealth from it. Not all of it, but some of it. And by not being able to get all of it, that actually ensures that it will continue to be affordable for other people, you know, to come and get it and to use it. And also, once again, protects gentrification, you know, protects people from coming in and changing that entire landscape. So I think land trusts are incredibly helpful in situations like this, you know, even beyond housing. I think it's a great protector.
Yes, indeed. We cannot talk about ending or reducing the racial wealth gap in Boston without community land trusts being on the table. Community land trust, cooperative housing, is a critical tool. But let me say, this is not a new tool. Actually, when you look at the history of Black economic life in this country, Black communities have always been pushing community land trust. It was one way to protect themselves today, gentrification, but then violence from fellow townspeople. And so cooperative housing, community land trust should not certainly be alien to, or at least presented as a new idea. Now, a few years ago, I would say maybe even 10 years ago, if you said community land trust in Boston, oh no, he must be socialist. Oh, that's scary. We're not, oh no. But community land trust, the narrative of community land trust has exploded. Mm-hmm. When you look at Mayor Walsh's Housing 2030 plan, community land trust was endorsed. We still have a long way to go. If you look at the housing units in Boston, the number of housing units, it's about 295,000-300,000 thereabout housing units. Less than 1% of those are under community land trust. So we have a lot of room to push and expand community land trust. Again, when I looked at the neighborhood of Mattapan and looked at vacant properties that are off the market, these are not vacant properties for rent or have been sold. These are unoccupied vacant properties. The census, the American Community Survey reported something like anywhere between this, and they can only do a range because it's a survey, between 200 and 400 vacant properties all across Mattapan. So we have major potential in Boston to take this on as a really important issue and push the envelope. I know there's some resistance to it, And that resistance may have to do with traditional ways of thinking of what is Black home ownership, but we have to challenge that.
Can you point to some of the earlier communities you talked about?
The expert on this is a scholar, and I don't know where she might be now, an African-American scholar, economist. Her last name is Gordon Nemhart. I forgot her first name. But Gordon Nemhart wrote a classic book about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, documenting this economic history of Black. If you want to go earlier, you could look at Harold Cruz, the late Harold Cruz, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, that was published in 1967. And in that book, he also explains how Black communities attempted to use cooperative housing, economic co-ops to not just realize mobility, but also to protect their families and their communities.
So, you know, I want to diverge just a teeny weeny, weeny, weeny bit, because there's something that's happening here, and it is certainly at the heart of our podcast, which is education, right? So all of this information that you just shared, Dr. Jennings, I don't know, I'm sure that there are many, the books that you spoke about, other books. What are the ways in which we need to be having conversations in our community right now that start to seed some of this understanding of how important it is, this lineage of the history of how we came to be where we're at? Because a part of this idea of the racial wealth gap is over a period of time, right? So I know we're going to talk about land trusts, and we have been talking about land trusts. We're also going to talk about, we're going to bring the conversation to health disparities and that as well. But there's another piece that is also, I think, about the wealth that we have within our communities, which is each one teaching one. This idea of education in both of you as doctors, right? And you in particular, Dr. Jennings, are a professor. So can you talk a little bit about how we might, bring people into the conversation, and what are some of the root things that we need to start understanding as a community to take advantage of some of the things you were speaking about?
Well, I think one is take on this debate. Dr. James made some really important points in terms of the benefits, the economic and social benefits of community land trust. And again, there's some pushback to that, because some people feel, they're not bad people, they just feel, well, wait a second, if I have a home and I'm building equity, you mean I can't sell it and make money? There is some pushback that we just have to encourage the debate and have full debates about the pros and cons even. But again, as we've been saying here, not just in the context of increasing Black home ownership, but in the context of how we move a community forward. What are the most important tools? The other thing I think should happen, which I think is lacking, and that is that our public schools don't teach our children enough entrepreneurship. Community land trust is really tied in certain ways to entrepreneurship. A group of people coming together, this is how we're gonna live, this is how we're gonna maintain the property. Those are really entrepreneurial skills. Unfortunately, entrepreneurship is something that is just lacking in our public education, and public schools. And I think it's a way to bring young people involved in this kind of discussion. Because remember, it's our young people, like Dr. King said, you know, we're looking at the future today. And it's our young people that have to be part of these conversations in a much more robust way.
Yeah, I think that I agree with you, including on your first point. You know, I agree with you on that, the pushback, you know, but in sharing your equity, I agree with you on that, actually. But I agree also that we don't teach children about entrepreneurship. We don't teach them about finance, You know, we don't teach them sort of like the basics of how you build wealth. And I'm a big fan of that, quite frankly. You know, I think it's there are organizations and companies like Ariel Investments, for example, in Chicago. They have books for children to teach those things like very, very early on. Because I think, I mean, kids are smart. They're talented and they could have great interest in this type of thing. So I'm a real proponent of teaching those things in school and teaching them in the home. You know, when I was about, listen, my father worked in the post office, as I was telling John earlier. But when I was 8 or 9 years old, he was buying me stocks. And I remember he used to show me these, like, these dividend checks. You know, these was like nominal amounts of money, you know, like sometimes cents, and, you know. But he was trying to introduce me to that and teach me that. And he was constantly sort of telling me things like, if you make a dime, you save a nickel. And this was the various different types of investment options and, you know, ways to invest now. And those things weren't available then. Yeah, he was teaching me these things early. So I really am, I really do support that, teaching those things in school, for sure.
Boston has these much vaunted educational institutions, meds, tech, financial. What's the role of the hospitals? What do you think the role of the hospitals are in terms of taking on this racial wealth gap? And what can their impact be?
I think hospitals have a huge opportunity to impact. Because first of all, at the rate things are, and I work at a safety net hospital, which in and of itself speaks to, you know, the economic deficits that our patients have. We cannot be effective clinically when people are having to, when they can't prioritize health because they're prioritizing survival. So with, you know, limited amounts of money, they're making decisions every day about how they spend their money. You know, do I buy food for the family, try to secure some housing, pay the utilities, or do I use it to pay for a prescription or to get transportation, to get to a medical appointment? I mean, it's a no-brainer for them. But meanwhile, their health is always spiraling. And actually, it's a vicious cycle. You know, say they have chronic disease like hypertension, diabetes, they can't manage it because they're prioritizing survival. So they come in with that disease out of control. Over and over and over again, they come in, we treat them and reset them to baseline, but then we're simply just discharging them right back to what's driving it without ever addressing what the root cause is. So it needs to start in medical school. People need to be really understanding and taught like how everybody lives and what, you know, the real struggles are. And basically starting out with just engaging with patients, because if you ask them what it would take for whatever their condition is to stabilize, they will tell you. But it's not the culture of medicine to really like engage with patients. It just isn't. You know, if people already have an agenda and that's what they're going after. They teach you to focus on disease. They don't teach you to focus on root causes. So they just chase disease. And so, but there are other things hospitals can do beyond that. You know, as anchors in communities, they have lots of economic power. You know, they can help to create more sustainable local economies through how they invest, you know, how they hire, how they procure, you know, procuring with intentionality to include communities of color as vendors and that type of thing, setting standards for that, quite frankly. And also investing in businesses in communities, enabling people to have ownership in things, not just perpetuating the same old cycles where people are just like paying rent for something or not becoming owners of something, just being operators of something, having opportunities to fill gaps in capital, you know, to become a part of the capital stack, you know, for it might mean the difference between for a business that is paying rent that continues to increase. It may be the difference between that person not being able to maintain that business and all the people who live in the community who work at that business and the business that they do, those people not being able to work anymore. It could be the difference between that and that that business owner actually being able to purchase a building. But it requires, again, an economic ecosystem. Like everything you do should be with that level of intentionality and looking through that lens. So every opportunity you have to commit to something in the way that you hire, in the way that you procure, the way that you invest is an opportunity for, you know, hospitals to do this. And they have to think about it differently. They have to move away from these sort of extractive kind of economic deals, you know, where, you know, this like, you know, like these kind of, you have to think of various different types of ways to give capital, you know, in terms of loans, long-term loans, loans without interest, you know, equity even, you know, various different things where even employee-owned, employee stock option plans, you know, where the employees get to become owners. So their wealth increases a lot too. So I guess what I'm saying is, A, hospitals, you know, need to have intentionality towards these things, and they can do it together even, particularly in a city like Boston. And they need to change their mindset and use a different paradigm of investing in that way.
It sounds like, and it was a question, but I think that you've answered it already. How can policies, right? You talked about root causes. We're talking about systems. We're talking about structures. We're also talking about policies and practices, right? That they need to change to shift the historic and present wealth gap. Is that correct?
Right. You know, there are other policies also. An example, the Massport policy. Recently, when they changed their policy about when people are bidding, you know, for development, they changed their policy, and you know, they are owners of a lot of you know land and seaport. And that Globe article in 2017 talked about no people of color having been able to be involved in any of those deals in seaport and all that development. Well, Massport changed its policy, and it made it so that when people are bidding, 25% of, you know, their bid has to be towards, include diverse, partners in the deal. You know, it goes along with construction, design, and everything else, you know, financing, which are also parts of it. And what that did was it wound up being able to bring in like 39 diverse, participants, you know, in the developers. And what that did was gave them more exposure to others in that space. And it's sort of like, from what I have read, already having a ripple effect, mm-hmm. you know, in that way. Uh-huh. So I think to some degree, you have to use policies to quickly change things because mm-hmm. others have even adopted the sort of Massport way, you know. And so that thing is already, you know, having impact. So sometimes you just have to make it happen. It's like, if you want to play, you have to do this.
I was thinking about, I know, the difference between, because sometimes we talk, when we talk about wealth, we put it on income, right? So the difference between income and wealth inequality, and what are the key dimensions related to both of them, right? And then how do we expect that, or do we think that that's going to evolve or change in the coming decades? Because, you know, we have this grand conversation about wealth, and sometimes people, well, they make so much money and, you know, that kind of thing. Or they talk about even welfare that they put in there and talk about how much money people get off of that. I mean, even recently in COVID, it's like, oh, everybody's quitting their jobs because they got all this money from the government and they don't need to be working anymore. Or, you know, the narrative sometimes gets skewed. So thinking about income and wealth and sort of, yeah, the dimensions of that.
Yeah, those two concepts are certainly related. But they're not the same. Income is what I earn, a salary. Wealth is, it can include income, but it also includes the assets that after you incorporate the debt that I owe, I have a net worth. And so these are two very different concepts. I mean, assets could be, it could be a vehicle, it could be a house, it could be a ring. Income is a bit more static. Again, related, but there are people in this country, people with zero income, who are the wealthiest people. Zero income, because income really, they almost don't need it. So these are two different concepts. But this goes back to the point you made, Dr. James, and how we teach young people some of these concepts and these financial concepts. And this is not a push for capitalism. You know, this is not, you know, that would be a silly critique, I think. This is a push for economic empowerment of our communities. But income, access to high-paying jobs is very important. I don't. You may be familiar with the report that was just done by I think it was Marvin Martin, Action for Equity.
Action.
Mm-hmm. They did a report showing the number of high-paying jobs that were available to Blacks, minimal in Boston. Those high-paying jobs, with very high wages, very high income, were held mostly by whites who migrate into Boston for jobs. And so again, this is, you know, these are the things we have to look at.
Wow. Speaking of that, how would you expect these, do you expect these trends to evolve, or do you expect them to change in the you know, kind of coming decade?
It depends, in my opinion. It depends on policies that are enacted, and it also depends on community organizing to support policies. And let me go back a little bit in terms of the racial wealth gap. The other factor in explaining the racial wealth gap is that for generations and generations and generations, Blacks were denied the political power to protect even the little economic gains they made. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about after slavery, 1965, Voting Rights Act, you know? And so again, a history of just making a little economic gain here or there, but not having the political, being denied the political power to hold on to that gain. We have instances in New York City, for example, when you look at the waves of European immigrants, Blacks were already there. Puerto Ricans were beginning to come in, and they held jobs that maybe at the time weren't the high status jobs, but they were displaced by European immigrant groups in service, retail, because Blacks did not have Blacks were denied the political power to protect the little economic gains that they were making. So how this is related to today, we have a good sense of what policies we should be pushing, but now those policies have to be strengthened with community organizing / political power to make it happen and make those policies sustainable.
Talk about a couple of those policies that would really benefit from community organizing. And
well, Dr. James mentioned some, I think, some really important ones when we look at businesses and direct economic activity. But I think something that's just happened in Boston is also important. For the first time in Boston's history, fair housing is incorporated into the zoning ordinances. And think about this. Since the 1950s, there have really been two narratives in Boston. You have the zoning narrative, corporate, you know, anything capital wants, anything big real estate wants, it's going to be good for the city. 1968, this other narrative emerges called fair housing. And those were really two separate narratives in Boston. They finally have come conjoined, which I think is a major policy victory. But we have to arm people with information about how to enforce that. What it means is that the next time a big developer comes into the community to say, well, look, I decided I want to do this, the BPDA is obligated now, legally obligated, to say, what is the impact of your plan on fair housing issues, and fair housing defined very intersectionally.
I love this, that we're looking at a specific policy. Are there any other, because you spoke earlier and I was going to ask the question and then we moved in a little bit of a different direction. You were talking about some of the policies and practices that were put in place to deny people, right? You're talking about some of the ones that we can look at right now. Are there some previous policies that were designed to alleviate the wealth gap that we might be able to look back at or re-engage with? Anything like that? Because I don't think that there's any one silver bullet, so to speak, that's going to shrink that wealth gap. Are there any other things that we can look to or be informing the listeners that we should be paying attention to or learning more about?
I think when we look at the civil rights movement, there were some examples in the civil rights movement. We really had two civil rights movements in this country, a national one, very important, but we also had a lot of local civil rights movements. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of examples that we can dig into in terms of this community pushing this or making sure that this happens or doesn't happen. We could look at some education reform that focuses on parent empowerment, for example, voter mobilization, so we do have some examples of victories that we could, look at and say, what can we learn from these examples?
Absolutely. We're learning together, we're sharing and disseminating information into our community. We are the organizers, we are folks that have land trust, and we're constantly needing to plant seeds.
Yeah, I was thinking, as you were talking, James, about community organizing, the importance of that. And, and now I think so. And then earlier you were talking about how when we talk about land trust, sometimes people are resistant to it. And now the emerging conversation, along with cooperative businesses and land trust, is reparations. And so as we think about policy, as we think about all the different roles of the hospitals and education, and all the stakeholders, and as we push that conversation at a regional level, a national level, a local level, sort of thoughts on that? And where do you think that will lead us? Yeah, and I see you both pointing at each other. I know you're both having...
Okay, so I'm going to say something that has gotten me in trouble, but has become more popular. And that is, reparations cannot be cutting a check on an individual basis. Reparations has to be comprehensive. Remember, it wasn't just during slavery and the post-slavery period. It wasn't just Black individuals that were being exploited. It was also Black communities, urban and rural areas. So reparations, I think, has to respond to that to a certain extent. And it's not an easy question. But how do we use reparations to reduce the racial wealth gap broadly defined, which means we have to look at the vestiges of slavery in the post-slavery period and its manifestations in continuing poverty gaps, in continuing unemployment gaps, health gaps. And so reparations, I think, is fantastic as a narrative, but it has to be a very comprehensive narrative, in my opinion.
I couldn't agree with you more. It has to be systemic, because the individual impacts of slavery and everything that has come from that has, individuals have been affected by the systemic situations that were created, and it affected people as individuals. And so I think it would be better applied to undo the systemic structures that have created what we see on an individual basis.
And you're thinking that we're not talking about it?
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying the conversation's just started in Boston. And so I'm hoping as it evolves.
They're national conversations.
Oh, they're national conversations. Yeah. And I think some people have been criticized for suggesting that, hey, it's not just about an individual paycheck, because racism and the history of racism is not just the individual. It's also a group of people, a racialized group of people that has to also be responded to.
Interesting. I also had this professor once who said to me when I was his student that there's never been a successful poor people's movement in this country.
Right.
Right? There's never been a successful. So I wonder sometimes that if we individualize it, this whole conversation, it sort of falls into that category. It won't be as successful if we don't view it as the system and taking it on.
And, you know, we do have class in the Black community. And that's the other thing we should be worried about. If we define reparations where I, as a member of the middle class, am going to be fine, but we still don't deal with these other issues mm-hmm. that low-income, working-class people are dealing with, then it becomes, I think it won't carry, it won't have the political weight. It won't have, you know, we won't be able to go to the grassroots and say, we need to organize around this. Well, why? When you're defining this in a way that that really doesn't impact everything that we're doing in our daily lives, you know? So one of the things, and don't get me going because I've been involved with some of these fights and they're over with them. But one of the things that I always was curious about is how one will prove that he or she is eligible for reparations. Mm-hmm. And I heard one scholar say, well, Black immigrants, they have to go back to their country to deal with reparations. But think about this. Going back to New York City and the history, the political history of New York City, African Americans and Black immigrants, Caribbean and from Africa, were always in solidarity around political issues, mm-hmm. always in solidarity. So all of a sudden, reparations is going to become a divisive tool among us. I think that's a problem.
Well, it's really great that you lifted that up. We are going to, prayerfully, our next conversation is going to be going more deeply into this idea of reparations. But one place, for me personally, as an educated woman here, a Black woman here, what about this idea, you know, again, not to keep spiraling backwards, this idea of even just getting to education, the loans. What about loan forgiveness? Could that be an aspect of, is that included in this idea of reparations? That's something that across the board, right? Is that also going to, for instance, fall only within the context of class? Is it just those who were able to get educated? And could that be a way, because this conversation is really about the racial wealth gap, right? So how many of us are, you know, I have a good income. I work for this organization, but I have a huge amount of student loan debt. So then when you think about what my wealth is coming out, if one could liken wealth also to this idea of being educated and how I can show up and how I can have agency and how I can engage in the society as a citizen to a certain extent because I've been educated, but then I have this big, huge debt that is sitting on my back. And so for me, when I think about issues of the racial wealth gap, that is a huge space. And so maybe we could just close out there because we're going to have that reparations conversation. But I think for me, a part of the reparations is loan forgiveness.
I agree with loan forgiveness 100% because, you know, education is one of those things that prevents you from reaching your full potential. And I don't think it should be based upon, you know, money, whether or not you can afford, because there again, you know, you're creating these two distinct pathways or populations. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, that's a systemic issue once again. And so I completely think that if you want to include it in reparations, yes, but it should be free anyway.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Ashe.
No, I definitely agree. And let's not forget that a lot of the Black and Latinx student debt does not ipso facto mean that these individuals graduated from school. You know, they may have been pushed out. They may, family responsibilities may have come up, but they still owe that money. And to me, that's unconscionable not to consider loan forgiveness. The other thing about loan forgiveness is that you're immediately freeing up dollars that go into spending in the community, consumer expenditures. It could be investments. You know what I mean? So this debt was the root of this debt was, in my opinion, corporate greed and greed in higher education. When you look at, you know, the origins of how people get this very high loan situation, and so it makes sense morally, but it also is actually happens to be a fabulous economic engine to release money that could be turned into wealth and investments.
Thank you. This is
a thread that could go on and on and on and on. I know that we could be here into the evening talking about this, and that's hence again DS&I deconstructing, right? Getting at the root of this. So quite frankly, it means that we have to invite you both back. And I hope you will join us again. But thank you again, Dr. Thea James, Dr. James Jennings, for being with us here today. And I think that we're going to wrap. That is DS&I Deconstructs.